Hi, I'm Still Gerry in for ZDNet Australia, and this week it's the end of the desktop metaphor thanks to the new design language of Windows 8. Well, maybe. In Windows 8, there's no pictures of folders and scroll bars and all that stuff. It's squares and rectangles for all the things. Now, Microsoft reckons that in the age of the millennials and the digital natives, I hate those terms, but you've got to speak the language, right? Well, they say that rendering a computer interface using the desktop metaphor, or any metaphor, isn't needed anymore.
We're at a point where our users are sufficiently confident with using information technology that they don't need the reassurance of those references to real-world objects. That would be Microsoft's argument.
Just display the content. That's the theory. There's no need to have buttons that look like, well, buttons.
The premise behind these new touch-first user interfaces is that instead you manipulate the content itself. You drag it, you drop it, you poke it.
But is this new interface style really the future? Or is it just product differentiation? We'll have a listen, you decide. Welcome to Patch Monday. The travels have been continuing for me this month. I spent most of last week as Microsoft's guest at TechEd 2012 on Queensland's Gold Coast. That's the annual get-together where developers and IT pros, by which they mean systems and network administrators and DBAs, learn about all the new stuff and the pointy-haired bosses get propagandized with the new architecture. Cloud scale was the new joke buzzword, and Microsoft is flogging their new products as the Cloud OS, give me strength. Well, the new interface style, formerly known as Metro, fascinated me. I mean, why do this? Why throw out the tried and true interface that served us for three decades? One session covered its design heritage. I followed that up in an interview, and that interview is our podcast this week. Now, one of the really obvious new things about Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8 when we see that, of course, is this whole interface which is not called Metro. Okay, so it's not called Metro. And what struck me about this, and I think anyone who sees this for the first time, is, of course, it's dividing the whole universe into squares and rectangles in a way that's vastly different from the interfaces that have gone before. Now, I must admit, I'm finding it a little hard to get my head around why we would even want to do this, but with me are a couple of people who can answer that question. Shane Morris from Automatic Studio and Nick Randolph from Built to Roam, from the design and UX side and the development side, respectively. Now, Shane, when I first looked at this interface, I thought, this is the CSI gadget wallization of Windows. It's like we're trying to make things look like a TV show. Why would you even want to do this? Now, that was my reaction. What was your reaction?
I'm still taking on board your reaction. That's not unreasonable. It's all about colour and movement, isn't it, after all? When I first saw the Windows Phone UI, which was sort of pre-release a while ago now, I was genuinely surprised. The flatness of it, an awful lot of white space. I mean, it was clearly a shift in direction from what we'd been seeing on the other platforms.
This is the design sense of white space, which of course can be red or blue.
Yes, white space can come in any colour you want. And I literally thought that Microsoft was being very clever and not revealing the final user interface. Instead, had put in place these square coloured placeholders that were going to where the user interface would be revealed. And I actually spoke to one of the Microsoft guys and said, you know, thinking I'm a bit of an insider, I'm like, come on, dude, you know, show me the real thing. He assured me that this was in fact the real user interface, and it turns out he was right.
Well, yeah, my surprise was the desktop metaphor that we're familiar with. Okay, it's, well, more than 20 years, 30 years old now, because it came out of Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Link to that on the podcast website for you youngins who have never heard of this and probably didn't even know that Xerox used to make computers, but that's going back a bit. To me, it said, okay, the desktop metaphor with folders and documents on a desktop, like this is very quaint. It's time for that to go. But my God, what are you doing? Is this just product differentiation?
Right. if Microsoft would say that we're in the era of the digital natives, and that referring back to those things that on the desktop metaphor, the trash can and the folders and the floppy disk for save, even the idea of having to save your files,
and I'll link to what a floppy disk is too.
Right. You know. We're at a point where our users are sufficiently confident with using information technology that they don't need the reassurance of those references to real-world objects. That would be Microsoft's argument. And when we think about, you know, millennials and digital natives, what's really interesting about them is that they no longer blame themselves when digital products don't work. It's the fault of their bank or their airline or their the transport company or whoever they're interacting with.
What you're referring to there is like if an older relative, you know, is working at the computer, hits the wrong button, gets an error message, oh, what have I done wrong?
Exactly. Whereas it's exactly the opposite with these young people these days.
And I think I've seen videos, you must have seen them too, of two-year-olds playing with an iPad or something, swiping stuff across the screen, then go to a printed magazine and try to do the same, swipe the pictures, and they don't change. What is wrong with this
thing? Exactly. I've seen the same video, and what we're seeing now is these kids are taking what they've learnt about life from their screens and trying to apply it to the real world. The exact opposite to what Xerox was trying to do by taking things from the real world, folders and desks and mice. Well, not mice, but trash cans. And
I don't know what you've got happening in your office.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. And applying it to trying to apply it to software. So that's why these new user interfaces have a lot of this, what we call the Chrome, sort of stripped out. The argument being, we can just focus on the actual information now.
Now, the Chrome is scroll bars, buttons like that, yep. Things which say this is a menu.
Yep. And things which aren't, at the end of the day, content. They're the controls that we put into a traditional user interface to manipulate the content. So in a traditional GUI, you select some object on the screen, and then from the menu bar or the toolbar, you perform a series of actions on it. The premise behind these new touch-first user interfaces is that instead you manipulate the content itself. You drag it, you drop it, you poke it.
And there's nothing to indicate that this can be dragged or dropped or poked.
Yeah, and as an old-school usability guy, that I found that quite confronting because I usually, traditionally, my job was to provide enough signals on screen to communicate to users what you're supposed to do. What we instead asking our users to do with these new interface is to explore for themselves, to prod things and see what happens. What that means is that we have to write much more robust software. We have to allow for all the possible things that our users could do and protect them from doing stuff that they'd regret.
Now, where did this particular design style come from?
Well, I guess there's a couple of places to point at. Firstly, this new user interface, I'm just going to call it Metro.
We'll bleep you out if necessary.
Yes, thank you. The Metro user interface does have some history in Microsoft. You know, when we look at content-focused applications like Media Center and Zune, you can see the genesis of this new language in those applications. Similarly, don't have a lot of Chrome. They focus on the content. There's a lot of animation, a lot of use of text. So that's the path that Microsoft has been following that brought us to the phone UI and the Windows 8 UI. In terms of sort of inspiration and influence, Microsoft also talk about some of the mid-20th century design schools, particularly Bauhaus and the Swiss School, which I'm sure you're about to ask me to explain. Mm-hmm. And we also talk about, and they also point to transport signage, wayfinding signage, and animation, motion design, and so these sort of four fields sort of come together to influence the new UI.
Well, the wayfinding signage, I mean airport signs, basically.
Yep.
That's really easy to see. That's rectangles. You know, mm-hmm. Lots of repeated rectangles, lots of simple colours.
Yep.
You know, linked to any airport photograph in the world, and we're familiar with that.
Yep.
Arrows, flat colours. Okay, I get that. Some of the others you mentioned, the the international school, the Swiss.
Yes, the Swiss school or the international design school. So, for those not familiar, the Swiss school arose sort of early last century, and really it was mainly in print media, in posters and advertising, book covers, stuff like that. And basically the premise behind this design movement was that if we just show the information in an authentic way, that is beautiful unto itself. So if we, and so you can think about posters and book covers and infographics, advertising from sort of mid-last century, stripped away a lot of the decoration, possibly used photography, because that was a new, being able to manipulate photography was new for print designers mid-last century. But focus on text, that's where Helvetica came from, the same movement, which was all about let's make an easily readable font that we can use at multiple sizes effectively, so that we don't have to have sort of, you know, font fruit salad in our designs. And so you can see that coming through in the Windows Phone and Windows 8 user interfaces, in the focus on text and the use of text to communicate a visual hierarchy and an information hierarchy.
The thing that came to mind then was your classic program for a symphony orchestra concert. And on a two-page spread, mm-hmm. you've got a photograph mm-hmm. of the violin or the orchestra mm-hmm. on one side mm-hmm. of every page. And let's say this is the season program, so it's yep. a page per concert, one every Saturday through spring. The left-hand side's always a photograph of the guest conductor. The right-hand side always has, maybe the top half of the page is completely blank white, and it's just simple. The headline, nice and big, the text, nice and small, clear gap.
Yep.
Pricing.
Yep.
Information.
And next time you look at something like that, just get out a pencil if you want and draw boxes around the text information, and you'll see that the designer has carefully set out a hierarchy for you just by using different font sizes and weights and by using alignment and white space, which is exactly what's going on when you look at some of these new user interfaces.
And you don't have a heading to say concert title colon.
Right,
like,
right.
You just, the title's there. Of course it's the title. It's the biggest thing on the page.
Right, exactly right. And the relative size of text helps you to group information in your head, and a good visual hierarchy means that you can imagine if you were, you know, 100 feet away, you could still see the grouping of the information. You could still form a structure to the information in your head, even if you couldn't read the text. And that's where white space comes in.
And that works, I can see, with very simple colour palettes, because you know, colouring doesn't really enter into it. Okay, that's the international style, the Swiss school. Bauhaus is the other one. We're
right.
not talking kind of David Bowie on heroin in Berlin here either, are we? Well, actually, we are.
Well, maybe. I don't know. So, I mean, everyone knows the Bauhaus catchphrase, form follows function, right? This idea that... So those guys who were mainly designing furniture and later architecture, and they were doing a bit of visual design as well, they had a similar sort of idea that if a sufficient and elegant design is the minimal design necessary to deliver the purpose. So if I unpack that a little bit, if you're designing a chair, the ideal chair from the point of view of the Bauhaus guys, and they're mostly guys, is that if the chair merely meets the function of being sat on, it's a well-designed chair, and the decoration is unnecessary.
So we're talking about a horizontal surface for you to put your bum on,
yes.
and some mechanism for holding that surface up off the floor.
Let's say, yeah, exactly. And so in the Bauhaus school, your design solution was meant to be derived from the function, and that was meant to lead you to the final form of the product.
I'm going to throw some links to some of this stuff on the podcast website, as I always do. I don't know why I keep repeating that. It's obviously an insecurity thing, but, you know, that's why we have a website for the podcast. Motion graphics was the third thing you mentioned,
yes.
in that list.
Yes. I'm finding this really fascinating because I've been designing user interfaces for a long time, and in the olden days we designed a series of static screens or windows and we strung them together in our user interface. We now have the ability, both in terms of the platform capabilities and also with the design tools that we have available, to start thinking much more carefully about how things move about on the page. And the great power of animation, of motion design, is that it leverages our natural, the way we naturally process information in the real world. Because as we, as I pan my head across here in the beautiful Gold Coast, I'm creating a panorama in my head. And my spatial memory is remembering that Nick's over to my left, you're over to my right, and Jupiter's Casino is straight in front of me. What, particularly on the phone, what Microsoft has done is try to leverage those same affordances. They're a type of affordance.
Affordance?
Which is the physical properties of objects that tell us how they work.
Okay. Button in an elevator is raised above the surface of metal it's in, so we know it's something we press on.
Yeah, and it's sort of roughly finger-shaped, and it looks, so it's got soft edges. It looks like something that I could safely press. What they're using, particularly on the phone, because they've got a smaller screen to deal with, is they're using those animations and transitions to help us form that mental model of where am I in the application? Where have I been? How is this information related? So we're seeing a lot less UIs that are about a series of static screens, dare I say it, like a traditional website, and more about content coming to you. So information folding in, appearing and disappearing, possibly on a single screen or on relatively few screens compared to a traditional application.
That was under the heading of motion graphics, though. So
yeah.
What can we get people to look at to get an idea of what you mean?
Go to YouTube, look for kinetic typography. There's a whole bunch of designers who do this stuff for fun, and they set film soundtracks or song lyrics. They make videos of the words bouncing around, and the impression and the intention is to use that motion to create a relationship between the information, but also to evoke emotional response.
Now, you said that in your presentation,
yeah,
someone tweeted, how can moving text trigger an emotional response?
So I guess we're going to have to talk about examples, right? If text is, we relate the movement of text to the movement of objects in the real world. So if something flies in, in a hurry and comes to a screaming halt, that has that resonates differently with me emotionally than something that fades beautifully out of a blur, for example.
Okay. And we presumably have experience with this sort of thing from other fields.
Right. So we see a lot of this in motion picture title design. Today we talked about the North by Northwest titles by Saul Bass, but we see it today. Catch Me If You Can was a great movie that had a great title sequence that used the movement of text to introduce the content that we needed to see, who was in, what's the film called, who produced it, blah, 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 but also to start to set up the tone of the movie. So it's interesting how we're asking information to do a lot more work than it used to.
Okay. That's an interesting challenge, and Shane Morris, we could talk about that for ages because this is an area that I love. But Nick Randolph, we haven't forgotten you over there. You are from a development background. You've listened to this conversation. What is your reaction when you hear this kind of stuff being talked about when you're used to building interfaces?
My first reaction is, oh my God, I'm going to have to build this stuff.
Right.
So, and quite often this is how engagements quite often form. So Shane and I have worked on a number of projects, some of which people might have seen, like the Qantas app and things like that. And quite often the engagement will start with a design discussion. And I think it should do, because that's fundamentally what people are going to use, and it's what they're going to experience. They don't need to know all of the list of technology that comes together to bring that experience to them. What they're interested in is actually engaging with the app. So I'm quite happy for that conversation to start around the design space. And yeah, it does trickle down to me to actually build quite a lot of the application that supports it. But it's not a one-way flow, because quite often I'll come across something that, I'll make some changes, and, as we go through that process, it's not just a Shane designs it and I build it. It's a two-way flow of communication. Mm. So I'll build it, and then we'll refine it. And so we'll go back through that design process, and, we'll take input from externals as well. And, it's a very iterative approach to doing that.
How much of a a different approach is it in terms of actually coding the thing, in terms of the tools available to you?
So tools and technology-wise, it's been a slow, a progressive evolution of the technologies from Microsoft, right? So we're not using anything that is radically different, like they're not introducing a brand new language to us. So particularly with Windows 8, we've now got, we're using web technologies like HTML and JavaScript, right? For Windows Phone and Windows 8, we can use the XAML and C# that we've been using for quite some time now. What is different, though, is the focus, right? So previously, the focus was very much on, let's expose the data from the back end and we'll just get the job done. You know, it's all about screens and not so much focused around the actual layout and the experience and the motion, okay? Mm. So whereas now, because those tools and technologies are there and we can quite rapidly build out that stuff, it gives us the freedom and then the time to actually focus on making sure we build a brilliant user experience.
I think, if just coming back to motion design, because I think it's a good example of how this is working with me and Nick, because I'm new to motion design, as most user interface designers are, and I can't just say to Nick or wireframe, and I'd like this element to slide in from the right, it should take about 0.75 seconds, I need an easing, I need a cubic easing with a slight jiggle at the end. I don't even know if that's right, and I have to prototype and play in order to get those transitions right anyway. One of the beauties of the tools that we've been using is that I can leave Nick well enough alone. I can muck around with those transitions, get it right, and all Nick needs to do is invoke those transitions at the right point. Sometimes even I can do that myself. So traditionally, you know, every time a designer makes a change, and let's face it, designers make a lot of changes, you had to go come crawling back to the developer and say, please, please, I had a better idea. Could you change it a little bit?
It's a good point. I mean, the traditional approach to building software has been, and that's even if we do get a designer involved, because quite a lot of software projects don't even bother with a designer, right? And historically.
Call me.
because there is a standard way of doing things, not standard-ish, but there's...
Yes, and a lot of organisations didn't see the value that design brings to a particular application, and that's particularly true of internal-based applications, right? So internet-style environments.
And that always struck me as weird, because your employees, you're paying money for them to be there, in front of this CRM system for 30 hours a week,
or
whatever it is.
So if they're not enjoying the experience, if it's slow, if it's not responsive, that builds up frustration, ergo people are not happy, you know,
I'd go even further than that, Nick. You know, a well-designed line of business application will inspire, dare I use that word, people to do their job better. If we provide information in the right way, people will treat their job as less about filling in the frickin' form that I have to fill in order to process this insurance claim, and more about how they can apply human skills of creative thinking and problem solving to their work.
It strikes me too that an approach which is about delivering pages, or pages in quotes, on a screen is almost a simple, you know, loop style of programming. What's the next page? Which button did they hit? Generate the next page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a much more interactive style of programming, is it not? I mean, it's much more akin to game development almost.
It's borderline. Yeah, it is getting to that point.
Yes.
You know, and there's a lot of discussion about what constitutes a game versus building an application.
That's another whole argument for another day, obviously.
And definitely we've seen that. I mean, if you're looking at building a game for the phone, you do have the choice as to whether you build it using a technology that's actually come from an application development perspective, or do you use a raw game engine, right? So, and a lot of the sort of the very simple 2D games you can build up quite quickly as if you were building an app.
Mm.
So, the difference between the two...
So we're 15 years into the having the web-ish... I can't do arithmetic in my head.
I'm still waiting for that fad to die, God knows.
But this is the thing. I remember when printed books started happening. It took about a century for it to settle down and go, here's where page numbers can be found. Here's where you have the running head of chapter headings across the top and so on. And you see, in the first century of printed books after Gutenberg, so much variation on that before it settled down into... this is what you do, and the left margin is X percentage of the width of the page, and blah, 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 and that's just how we make a pocket paperback novel.
Mm.
That's the template. Mm. We're really at the beginning of that process, aren't we?
Yeah, and I mean, that process happened much quicker with the web.
Sure.
You know, those
because we could all talk to each exactly. other without sending a donkey to the next village.
Exactly. Exactly. When we think about these new UI paradigms, and now I'm not thinking about Windows 8 and Windows Phone now, I'm thinking about, you know, gesture-based, waving your hands in the air type UI and voice recognition and, you know, sort of new natural user interfaces. Where those conventions will come from, or whether instead we decide there should be no conventions, just like there are no conventions when I talk, or fewer conventions when I talk to you, I don't know. I don't know the answer.
You know, then again, I'm going to say there are. We have a lot of eye contact going on. There's a lot of way we do voice intonation to indicate, is it time for the other person to speak? Am I finishing? I lean forward if I'm interested. I kind of lean back and scratch my chin if I want you to explain more because mm-hmm. I'm confused mm-hmm. and so on. Nick, you're smiling over there. None of this comes across in the audio. We've focused so much on design. Shane's given us some pointers for where we might look for an understanding of this world. From a development side, where and how would you recommend someone start getting their head around this stuff?
I'll just go back to my smile for a second. I mean, the smile comes around because my initial comment was, oh my God, I've got to code this, right? So as we start to get away from just a mouse and a keyboard and we start to deal with a touch input, all of a sudden we've got an additional form of input that we've now got to deal with. Now, building for the phone, that's been okay because touch is your only form of input. Mm. But if you're now talking Windows 8, where we could potentially be on a slate or we could be on a desktop with a 27-inch monitor, mouse and keyboard, all of a sudden it means that you've actually got like every single page or unit that you put on a page, you've got to think about how the user is going to interact if they're doing it with touch on a small screen, large screen, keyboard, mouse. You know, are they going to be using a screen reader?
You've put me off a career in development straight up.
But there are some complexities there, but again, the tool set are there to support you in doing that. But I think going forward, I mean, you talked about the conventions about us communicating to each other. Those are highly complex, and even though our brain's sophisticated enough to comprehend them,
if we're going to
have to code that and deal with that as another form of input, it is a challenge. And we've seen that with Microsoft's Kinect, and they've started to get some of those gestures and that capability there. But for anybody who's ever played around with the SDK, it's not a trivial thing to do, okay? The basics are there in terms of working out what gestures are there. But again, you're dealing with some very complex type of input there. So.
Then again, the first time we had to get our head around object-oriented programming communicating by asynchronous messages to objects, you know, that was what am I doing here? And that is something you learnt over the course of months or years to become fluent in it.
Yes, correct. And, you know, we mostly don't go down to the, you know, assembly-level language style of writing code anymore, do we? Quite often build on the shoulders of giants, to coin a phrase.
Yes, I've heard that somewhere
several
before.
Times before at this conference.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time, right? So as we go forward into those more complex types of interactions, the expectation will be that there will be frameworks, there will be, you know, technologies that, you know, vendors will produce that will make that form of input easier to comprehend and easier to process from an application's perspective.
We'd better wrap it there because there's other things for us to cover. I'll give you a chance to quickly tell us some other things you've done that we might have a look at. The Qantas app was one of them.
Yeah, just 2 weeks ago, our Qantas app that we did in conjunction with Qantas, obviously.
That would be convenient.
Well, yeah. It made it easier. It won the... It won best app on Windows Phone at the AMIA Australia Mobile Awards, so we're pretty excited about that. We've also collaborated on National Australia Bank's recent Windows Phone application. We're working on some Windows 8 apps that you'll have to wait to launch to find out what they are.
Excellent. I'll look forward to it. Shane Morris from Automatic Studio and Nick Randolph from Build to Rome.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.
And so ends another edition of the Patch Monday podcast. If you have any comments on this week's episode, in particular, if you've been developing for the new Windows 8 user interface or if you've been playing with it, tell us what you think. I must admit, I'm still a little sceptical. You can either type some words in at the website or to leave an audio comment to include in next week's program, either Skype me or phone Sydney, +61 2 8011 3733. I'm still Gerrion for ZDNet Australia. I'll be back with you next Monday for another Patch Monday podcast. Until then, have a good one.